collection of music today. Rob will be back next Sunday, and as well as the usual Bach cantata, he has music by Englishmen abroad, including Holst, Bax, Delius and Elgar. So have a pleasant remainder of your weekend, and I do hope you enjoy what Radio 3 has to offer you over the coming week.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. Studio production this morning was by Neil Miners. And let's have a look ahead to later this week.
Radio 3 live in concert. A new choral work by Jonathan Harvey at the opening night of the London 2012 Festival. The first UK performance of Veltatos, a powerful musical plea for world peace. A vast work for mixed chorus, children's chorus, orchestra and organ, with a libretto drawn from six of the world's largest religions. Live from Symphony Hall, Birmingham, with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and Edward Gardner. Thursday night, 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Early music inspired by the myths of Greece is the subject of the Early Music Show in an hour from now here on BBC Radio 3. But next, this lunchtime, with the time just after midday, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Professor David Phillips is President of the Royal Society of Chemistry. He's the Senior Science Ambassador for Schools and has had a long association with Imperial College. His particular area of expertise is photochemistry, and his work in this area has won him the prestigious Porter Medal. He's a hugely captivating lecturer, and amongst his publications is one that has become known as the Bible. Tell me about that, David.
Well, there is a technique for looking at a fluorescence, which is light given out by excited molecules. And we eventually wrote a manual as to how to do this experiment properly. A slim volume, it's a monograph, and it became hugely useful, I think, to laboratories throughout the world. And one day I was in California and I was at a conference and we were relaxing in the evening, having some drinks. And I was sitting next to a young man who said, "I didn't get your name." And I said, "I'm David Phillips." And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "You're not the David Phillips who wrote the Bible, are you?" And so that's where the name came from, yes.
You've touched on this particular field, which is really the difference in many ways between light and heat, isn't it?
Well, what light does with a molecule is to take an electron which is in orbit, if you like to think of it in those terms, around the nuclear framework of the molecule, and it moves it into a different region of space, a different orbital, and that takes a lot of energy to do that. So when you have done it, the molecule has a great deal of energy, and it needs to get rid of that energy. One of the ways of doing it is just to give the light back out again. That's the fluorescence or other forms of luminescence. But very often it undergoes chemical reactions. And the interesting thing is that the kind of chemistry you get from these excited states is rather different from the kind of chemistry you get from molecules which are just heated. So it opens up a whole new pathway for chemical reactions. I can give you a simple example. Vision. In your eye, light is hitting the retina and is causing a molecule to open up and twist through 180 degrees and then reform again. And in doing so, it pushes some proteins aside, and that's the vision process. Now, if you think about it, if that reaction were possible thermally, just through heat, you'd have permanently fogged vision. But it's exclusive. It can only be done by light, and therefore you have sharp vision.
I thought, if I might, I'll read a little review of one of your lectures, which it gives such a wonderful idea, and then we can talk a little bit about it. Sure. The diversity in both age and educational training of the capacity audience rival the diversity of coloured liquids, glassware and implements that decked the lecture bench before them. What would Professor Phillips do with the liquid nitrogen, the plasma globe, or the mysterious figure in the crib? These questions were answered in a series of explosions, fires, and bright flashes that typify his demonstrations. Throughout, he presented the history of light as a tool in medicine, starting with the basics of fast and slow chemical reactions and building up to the state of the art in laser surgery and photodynamic therapy. No wonder your lectures are popular.
Mm. Well, I think that you have to be very careful. It would be very easy to give a magic show, if you like, where the basic science does not come across, and I refuse to do that. Mm. I think you should use theatricality and props in order to tell some real science to the listeners. To that end, I mean, I'm not afraid of using props, and I enjoy doing it. I enjoy being on stage. But I think if there were not a serious scientific story to get across, it would be ephemeral. It wouldn't be worthwhile doing.
How did you develop a fascination for this particular field? I mean, was it just chemistry in general, or was there something that really caught your attention early on?
Well, at school, I guess I was equally interested in physics and chemistry, but I took the wrong combination of A-level subjects, so that at university at that time, only chemistry was open to me. So it's not surprising that I became a physical chemist, sort of halfway house. And so I decided this was an interesting area and went off to the United States to do a postdoctoral fellowship with the grand old man of the subject, and that really gave me the grounding. And I've never lost the enthusiasm for it.
Another enthusiasm I think you've not lost, and we'll come on to music in a moment, is travel and visiting places. You're just back from Beijing in the last day or two. And I know that the first music you chose because of your visit to Moscow, which was a very important one, wasn't it?
It was character-forming. It came after my time in the United States, in fact. I had decided then I was European and I wanted to come back to Europe. And I thought I'd have to do another postdoctoral fellowship while I looked around for an academic position. I happened to meet a Russian in Texas, where I was, who was very senior. He was deputy director of an institute. And he said, well, if you want another year, why don't you come and work in Moscow? And it seemed like a sufficiently off-the-wall thing to do. And I said yes, and so that's where I went.
Yeah. And this music?
Not speaking the language very well at the beginning, what sort of pursuits were open to you? Music was one, ballet was another, so I really sort of fell in love with the Bolshoi at the time. Mm-hmm. Opera was another, although I didn't go very often to opera, but theatre was kind of lost on you because you couldn't understand the nuances. So I became a very regular music attendee, mm-hmm. and it was very difficult to get tickets because all Russian music was immensely popular and everybody wanted to go. But Baroque music, they were less fond of, and they were still quite a bit of anti-German feeling at the time. This was in the 60s. And so you could get tickets for Baroque concerts, and so I went to a lot.
And who did you hear playing it on that occasion?
Well, this was the Oistrakhs. It was David and Igor Oistrakh, and both consummate musicians, but together in that kind of atmosphere, it was just an electrifying performance. It was wonderful.
Vivace, the first movement of the Bach Concerto in D minor for two violins, BWV 1043. We heard David and Igor Oistrakh playing the violins with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Goossens. Bach is always said to be of particular appeal to people with an orderly scientific mind like yours. Do you think that's so, or is it just that you love the music anyway?
Well, it's said to be mathematical, and I think there is something appealing to scientists about it. But scientists have Catholic tastes. I mean, I know some people who have appalling tastes in music, I have to say. But yes, I do think there is something appealing about the regularity and the rhythms, actually, also are there.
We said how important travel was, and we've been to Moscow, and about just a bit more than a decade later, you found yourself on your first trip in Brazil.
Yes. I had actually been in Argentina. I was teaching a course. This was pre-Falklands War, of course. And spent 3 weeks there with my wife and young daughter. And we stopped off in Rio on the way back and stayed with an ex-student and had a wonderful time, spending sort of 5 days being royally entertained. They were from a very wealthy Brazilian family. And he took me to a concert, which is where this next piece of music will be coming from.
No sertão, mãe que me criou, leite seu nunca me serviu. Preta Bá foi que amamentou, filho meu, filho do meu filho. No sertão, mãe preta me ensinou. Tudo aqui nós que construiu, filho, tu tens sangue na cor, como tem todo esse Brasil. Lele, oh, lele. De Angola, África,
oiê!
Pra Moçambique, Congo, África,
oiê!
Para a nação Bantu, África,
oiê!
Do tempo do quilombo, África, pelo bastão de Xangô e o Caxangá de Oxalá, filho Brasil, pede a benção, mãe África.
Pelo bastão de Xangô.
Irmãos de Angola, África,
oiê!
Pra Moçambique, Congo, África,
oiê!
Para a nação Bantu, África,
oiê!
Do tempo do quilombo, África, pelo bastão de Xangô e o Caxangá de Oxalá, filho Brasil, pede a benção, mãe África.
Pelo bastão de Xangô e o Caxangá de Oxalá, filho Brasil, pede a benção.
Irmãos de Angola, África,
oiê!
Pra Moçambique, Congo, África,
oiê!
Para a nação Bantu, África,
oiê!
Do tempo do quilombo, África, pelo bastão de Xangô e o Caxangá de Oxalá, filho Brasil, pede a benção, mãe África.
Pelo bastão de Xangô.
Brasil, pede a benção, mãe, a brigar. Pelo bastão de Xangô, de Caxangá, de Oxalá, filho Brasil, pede a benção, mãe, a brigar.
Did you know the work of Sivuca prior to going to Brazil, David?
No, Lewis? I didn't. And so I was introduced to it by this colleague, this friend. The reason I chose it is because it represents the sort of music I would have listened to when I was a teenager, pre-pop days, of course, and the popular music was traditional jazz and jazz of various sorts. And a lot of the jazz I like, which is West Coast, United States of America jazz, had a lot of Brazilian rhythms in it. But I think more importantly, the rhythms you hear there are immediate and basic. And I don't think I understood at the time just how much rhythm there was in classical music. And it sort of opened my eyes when I started really to listen to good music that all of the basics were there, but they just weren't as crudely expressed as you have in that sort of record. But that's a lot of fun. I enjoy it.
My Africa by Sivuca. Well, rhythmic energy is certainly a hallmark of our next composer.
Indeed. And that's really one of the reasons I've chosen it. We listen to a lot of Handel, mainly the choral music, but I've chosen this being a soloist because I think it's a particularly beautiful recording and it shows the quality of his writing very early on, of course, but it's the rhythm also which is so appealing.
This is from Ariodante, isn't it?
It is.
That one. The artist is the wonderful and sadly late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. What is she singing about here, David Phillips?
Well, she's singing about the constancy. The words are, "With the wings of constancy, love raises his flight. He makes faith and hope triumph in the heart." So it's a song about love and faithfulness.
Alzai suo volo mor, con l'ali di Costanza, con
Just a great example of the rhythmic energy that drives the music on. Beautiful.
And an interesting example, too, of the way composers began to treat the human voice as another instrument, with a sort of cadenza at the end.
Mm, absolutely. And
we heard Con Lali di Constanza from Act One of Handel's Ariodante, with Lorraine Hunt Lieberson and the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan. David Phillips, some of the most exciting advances in your field, photochemistry, in medicine and practical application.
Well, currently, of course, the world is trying to harness solar energy, because ultimately that will be the only energy source we have. And there are huge efforts going into that and some real progress. My own field is not that, but I have been concerned with using light in medicine, particularly trying to treat cancer using a dye stuff which you inject into the bloodstream, which specifically absorbs a colour of light that it has to be red, in fact, which you then excite the molecule. That turns on some chemistry which destroys the tumour.
Like many people, I think, you have found yourself leaning more and more towards chamber music.
I have. I don't know whether that's a function of age or of how much
taste
music
is.
You've listened to. I enjoy the intimacy of it and the very clear interplay between the instruments. And it's something which I kind of draw an analogy with being in a group of scientists, where each of you brings a different skill and the sum total of what you contribute is greater than any individual. And so chamber music for me represents a kind of cooperative human effort, which is done in other fields than music. But this is just wonderful to listen to.
Well, and of course, when you have just three or four players or five working on a piece and listening to each other and having a dialogue, you can get a greater degree of perfection and intensity than if you've got, say, 200 people, you know, is in an opera, or 100 in an orchestra.
It's also, I think, that interplay, that human interplay, which comes across so well.
And, of course, there is a practical thing. You know, chamber musicians can rehearse as long as they want.
Mm.
You often only get 3 hours or so with an orchestra before a concert, you know, if you're lucky, six.
Yes, indeed.
So the music you've chosen?
It's the Dvorak Piano Quintet, Opus 81, and I particularly want it with Clifford Curzon, because I think in all the recordings I've heard of piano chamber music, his is the most brilliant. The clarity of his playing is just absolutely unbelievable.
And perhaps not surprising, given your other choices, you've gone for the scherzo, the Furiant.
Indeed. I come back to a rhythm, I suppose, but it drives you along, and it's very uplifting music also.
Thank you.
The third movement, Scherzo, Furiant, from Dvorak's Piano Quintet, Opus 81. We heard Clifford Curzon with the Vienna Philharmonic String Quartet. Beethoven next, and I think really, David, this does slightly reflect your frustrated career as a pianist.
Well, I have only myself to blame. I stopped doing it. The reason, I think, partly from pressures, but really my father was an extremely accomplished pianist. And I was always conscious that he was better than I was and always would be, I thought. And so that's a kind of inhibiting feeling. But it's an instrument I love, and I felt I had to have some Beethoven. And so we chose the next piece.
You've chosen the concerto which you would love to have taken round the world.
Yes, if only, if only.
And this particular movement, again, it's quite a rhythmic one.
Yes, I guess I'm a pretty optimistic person. So most of the music I've chosen has that optimistic feel to it. Not all, but most of it.
Actually, that's nice, because very often people are surprised when they review their list of choices at how melancholic it is. Because when you think of it, a lot of the great moments in music have a kind of cathartic sadness to them. Mm. But uplifting music that has a great spirit and joy to it, of course, is equally important, but we don't perhaps think of it as always being, you know, the height of the art.
Well, I would have to say that I'm untutored in music and that I'm not a musician, so I choose music from the heart rather than from the head, perhaps. And I do listen to uplifting music because it makes one feel good about the world.
Thank you. Wonderful use of a lyrical idea contrasted with a very dynamic one.
Absolutely. And the feeling of the interplay of the orchestra and the piano are just amazing.
That was the third and final movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in G, Opus 58, the Rondo, and it was played by Emil Gilels with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Leopold Ludwig. this opera that we're turning to next, David Phillips, is considered by many people to be possibly the greatest opera ever written.
Well, I subscribe to that view. I have to say it was my first love. I came to opera kind of in midlife, having tried and not really. I think I tried with Wagner, and that possibly wasn't the right way around.
Wagner's strong stuff to sort of, cut your teeth on.
I fell in love with this opera when we were living in Southampton and the Glyndebourne Touring Opera came. And so in the same week, we saw The Marriage of Figaro and 2 days later, The Magic Flute. And the sets for that opera were done by David Hockney, which kind of has a resonance there this year. But I've gone back to the opera I probably love most, and that's Figaro. And I've chosen the finale because it is, for me, the best example of ensemble singing that you will ever hear. And it has all the human emotion in it as well.
And that's the great triumph of music over every other art form in some ways, because there's no other art form where you can have people simultaneously expressing different emotions and yet all taking part in the same piece of music.
It comes together, yes. It's, I think, is a triumph which will never be bettered. Gente, gente, larghe, larghe, il padrone. Gente, gente, aiuto, aiuto, son perduto. Cosa vende, cosa vende? Il scelera, tommasani, tommai fama, tole conquiste, tale ver. Son stordito, sbalordito, di ogni parte, e son siete. Infano, resistete, uscite, madama, il premio l'avrete di vostro destà. Faccio, mia figlia, mia madre, madama, scoperta è la trama, è la perdita è qua, è la perdita è qua.
Perdono, perdono!
No, no, non saranno, perdono, perdono, la mano, guardarlo!
Thank you.
the conclusion to Mozart's opera The Marriage of Figaro, the Act 4 finale, with the English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliot Gardiner. Now, you have very strong feelings, and in a sense I suspect you had even stronger feelings before you visited Russia yourself, which rather coloured for a while your feeling about Russian culture.
I didn't know much about Russia before I went, except that they were allies in the Second World War. But like all young children brought up in the 40s, I was led to believe that Britain stood alone and we effectively won the war. And it wasn't really until I lived there that I became conscious of whatever sacrifices this country had made, and they were real, and many families touched by this, my own included, they were on a different scale, a much smaller scale, than what had happened in Russia. And that was all revealed to me during the year that I was there, largely through my Russian teacher, who I had 4 hours a week with, very formidable woman, but we got on very well. And she really brought home to me that something like 26 million Russians were killed during the Second World War, and the same number, of course, through their own actions on each other, through Stalin's purges and whatever.
Pretty dreadful kind of double whammy to be involved in that side of war and have Stalin killing a whole load.
Well, a lot of his killing, of course, came just before the Second World War, which depleted the capacity of the Red Army to withstand the onslaught.
And is that thought slightly behind your choice of the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony?
Well, we talked earlier about perhaps people choosing music that was rather darker and more sombre than my particular choices, and I could easily have chosen some Shostakovich which would answer that description. But I like this piece in particular because it's Shostakovich, the composer, cocking a snook at the party, and in a very clever way, so he's not discovered. So the Russian authorities saw this as a piece of triumphal music which was celebrating the Communist Party and the Russian Narod, the people. In fact, everybody now thinks that he is celebrating the freedom of the individual and his freedom to write this kind of music and get away with it. So it in fact comes out as being rather optimistic music.
Yes, that swagger could be cocking a snook, and it could be about the triumph of the human spirit.
For me, it's representative of all human effort in science as well as humanities. It just is magnificent. It's the sort of music you really need to hear live, where you get blasted back in your seat by the orchestra.
The last few pages of the Symphony No. 5 by Shostakovich, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Bishkov. Well, David Phillips, thank you very much for taking us both on a little world tour and indeed on these pieces of music that you find so uplifting.
Well, thank you for allowing me to indulge myself.
Professor David Phillips was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the political biographer D.R. Thorpe. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
To be speaking to you now through the BBC has a very special meaning for me.
We present the Reef Lectures.
It means that once again, I'm officially a free person.
On BBC Radio 4, the economic historian Neil Ferguson explores the role of man-made institutions in driving global change.
Why did the West get so much richer and more powerful than the rest of the world?
The Reef Lectures 2012.
And why is that slipping away?
On Tuesday morning at 9.
What's gone wrong with Western institutions? They used to be so good.
Over on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Ian Skelly.
A general election with implications for the whole of Europe is being held in Greece. European leaders fear that a victory for the Syriza party, which strongly opposes the terms of Greece's international loan agreements, could result in the country leaving the eurozone. Polling stations close in 4 hours. Details have emerged of a plan circulated by the President Hollande of France to resolve the eurozone crisis. It calls for growth measures this year worth 120 billion euros, the pooling of debt, and a new framework for regulating the financial system. The Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, has announced that there's to be a major refurbishment of the Rolls-Royce plant in Derby to allow for the building of reactors for nuclear-armed submarines. He said the details will be announced in Parliament tomorrow. Activists in Syria say thousands of government forces have intensified their bombardment of the country's third biggest city, Homs. Syrian troops have also been attacking rebel forces in suburbs in and around the capital, Damascus. A second and final day of voting is taking place in the presidential election in Egypt. So far, turnout has been low as voters choose between two candidates, one a former associate of the ousted president, Hosni Mubarak, the other from the Muslim Brotherhood. People who are off work on strike will no longer be able to claim working tax credit under new rules to be introduced next year. Ministers say benefit claimants should pay the price for choosing to strike. The Olympic flame has passed through Durham on the 30th day of its tour through Britain and Ireland. One torchbearer, the England cricketer Paul Collingwood, turned the flame upside down and mimed a batting stroke to the cheers of crowds outside Durham Cathedral. The weather for this afternoon, most areas will see sunny spells and a scattering of showers. The wind will be lighter than of late, though. Maximum temperatures will range from 12 to 18 degrees Celsius, and rain will push into south and east England overnight. Well, that's the BBC News and the weather. It's now 3 minutes past one.
And time for the Early Music Show, introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
The overture to Monteverdi's opera Orfeo, first given more than 400 years ago in Mantua as a private palace entertainment, and one of the earliest music dramas that's still regularly performed. Stroll around any art gallery or museum and you'll soon come across a painting or artifact that depicts one of the ancient Greek legends. Some are still familiar, like Orpheus, the musician, poet and prophet who descended into Hades to try and rescue his dead bride Eurydice. But other stories can be harder to identify these days, which is a shame because they do seem to pervade almost every area of Western culture, painting and sculpture, poetry, and of course, they're often the inspiration for Baroque music. Well, we have an unashamedly mixed musical menu on the show today. Some excellent ensembles playing a variety of different pieces, all of them connected to some of the great myths of ancient Greece. We're going to hear about Jason and Hercules in a moment. But first, another piece on the Orpheus story, this time reflecting on our hero's famous musical skills. Come, woeful Orpheus, with thy charming lyre, and tune my soul into thy skilful wire. Some strange chromatic notes do you devise that best with mournful accents sympathise. A five-part song by the Elizabethan composer William Byrd. The Hilliard Ensemble with Come Woeful Orpheus by William Byrd, published in 1611. Of course, stories from the ancient world were being harvested for works of art and music long before the 1600s. Medieval and Renaissance poets such as Dante, Boccaccio and Petrarch in Italy found inspiration through the medium of Latin and the works of Ovid. And in France, the 14th century poet and composer Guillaume de Machaut left us with the rather romantic song we're going to hear in a moment, which compares the brave exploits of three classical heroes with the simple charms of love. Machaut was a musician who made it his business to break new ground, particularly when it came to the still fledgling idea of harmony. In fact, his music can sound quite weird to us today because sometimes not only would there be two different tunes sung together, but they had different words too. And within the text,